Nukes and money. Well, you didn't think they were doing it for our health, did you? Nuclear is all about the money. Usually massive amounts of government taxpayer money that flows out for weapons, reactors, mining, radioactive waste. The range of toxic nuclear issues and dangers that spans a wide range of issues and companies. As an individual investor, you might rightly want to put your money into companies that don't have anything to do with nuclear. But how do you know? How can you be sure? What does your financial advisor know? What's an ethical person of the genuinely green persuasion to do regarding their investment choices? It takes a financial expert, one who has worked on ethical investments for many years, to get us the key information. And when she tells you,
so I think for the individual who's looking to invest in a way that's aligned with their values, it starts with asking questions about, like, does your firm look at nuclear weapons? Are you investing in any of those companies that make them? If you are investing in those companies, how are you using your voice to try to influence them and change their behavior or looking to exit from them, recognizing that changing their behavior might be a long haul?
Well, when Mary Beth Gallagher of Domini Impact Investments, a mutual fund firm that as policy does not invest and never has invested in nuclear weapons companies, tells you what you need to be doing to assure that your financial investments line up with your personal beliefs, you start to understand how, if we're not careful, we may inadvertently be giving our money to support that dirty, deadly, awful, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we learn about how our finances may inadvertently be supporting companies that make components of nuclear weapons and what you can do to prevent that from happening. We talk with Mary Beth Gallagher, Director of Engagements for New York-based Domini Impact Investments, a woman-led mutual fund with the stated goal of investing for universal human dignity and ecological sustainability. I originally heard her speak at the United Nations during the meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prevention of Nuclear Weapons last December. Mary Beth lifts the veil on what it takes to make certain your funds, however limited they might be, do not go towards any company that manufactures nukes. We'll also have nuclear news from around the world, the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story with Linda Pence Gunter, the Nuke Watch Report with John LaForge, and more honest nuclear information than anyone at the Oscars bothered to say on camera. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, March 12, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Last week, a bipartisan vote in the U.S. Senate passed the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act extension and expansion. The Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, RECA, was enacted in 1990 and provides a one-time benefit payment to individuals who have gotten sick or died as a result of exposure to radiation from atomic weapons testing or uranium mining, milling, or transportation. It's currently set to expire in June of 2024. And this measure would extend the existing RECA to the year 2029 and include victims in Missouri, Alaska, Colorado, Idaho, Montana, Kentucky, Tennessee, and Guam. Ohio is also seeking to be included in RECA because of 7 decades of radioactive contamination stemming from the Portsmouth Gaseous Diffusion Plant in Piketon, Ohio. Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown has secured a commitment to work to add workers from the plant and residents living in several zip codes across Pike and Scioto County to RECA. And Senator Ben Ray Lujan from New Mexico, a sponsor of the legislation and leader on the issue, announced that he would work with Senators Brown and Vance of Ohio to add Pike and Scioto County residents to the program. The U.S. State Department has urged a rigorous safety evaluation of a proposed joint Russia-China plan to establish a nuclear-powered lunar base within the next decade. Their stated purpose is to one day support settlements on the moon. At this time, there is no suggestion that the planned project has a military component. But if it did, do you think they would admit it? The project may take place somewhere at the turn of 2033 to 35. For the record, the United States, Russia, and China are all members of the United Nations Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. This from Edwin Lyman, a physicist and director of nuclear power safety for the Union of Concerned Scientists. He wrote, "A few years ago, the nuclear industry went begging to Uncle Sam for subsidies to keep operating nuclear plants from shutting down. Congress gave them $6 billion. But hardly any of that money has been spent because the utilities could not prove that they needed the money. So instead of redirecting the money to a useful purpose, Congress took $2.7 billion and gave it to uranium enrichment companies to produce a fuel called HALEU, H-A-L-E-U, high-assay, low-enriched uranium, that is not used by any operating power reactor. That is a total perversion of the intent of the fund. HALEU is needed for the mythical and not yet existing small modular nuclear reactors, none of which has ever been built or tested." Lyman continues, "It is as if the account was labeled handout to the nuclear industry for whatever. What poor stewardship of taxpayer money." Here's Linda Pence Gunter with this week's Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story.
A handful of Hollywood celebs, some highly recognizable, including Jane Fonda, Barbara Streisand, Lily Tomlin, and Michael Douglas, as well as musicians such as Jackson Browne and Graham Nash, just signed their names to a letter published in the LA Times, urging that we make nukes history. Hooray, right? Well, only half hooray. The Hollywood letter was part of a quickly launched campaign to coincide with the Oscar buzz around the successful feature film Oppenheimer in order to leverage attention for the need to abolish nuclear weapons. The Make Nukes History campaign reminds us that while Oppenheimer is history, nuclear weapons still aren't, but that we can put an end to what J. Robert Oppenheimer started. So far, all so good. Far too few of us are thinking about nuclear weapons and the threat they pose, let alone doing something about getting rid of them. It's an important message that needs reiterating. Meanwhile, Oppenheimer duly swept 7 Academy Awards on Sunday, but only Cillian Murphy thought to make a meaningful statement from the stage. At the end of his Best Actor acceptance speech, Murphy said, "We made a film about the man who created the atomic bomb, and for better or for worse, we are all living in Oppenheimer's world. So I would really like to dedicate this to the peacemakers everywhere." The Make Nukes History letter in the LA Times was surprisingly skimpy, failing to get at the heart of the 2 key takeaways missed in the Oppenheimer film: the unwilling, unrecognized, and still uncompensated victims of Oppenheimer's original Trinity bomb, and the ongoing harm down generations to all peoples whose lands were seized and used for atomic tests. Read the letter. "At a time of great uncertainty, even one nuclear weapon, on land, in the sea, in the air, or in space, is too many. To protect our families, our communities, and our world, we must demand that global leaders work to make nuclear weapons history and build a brighter future." Demand indeed. Some of us have been doing this for decades, and we have a treaty for that. But thank you for waking up. But what does "build a brighter future" actually mean? That, it turns out, is the slogan of the organization behind the orchestration of the Hollywood letter and Oscar campaign, the Nuclear Threat Initiative. Let's first take a look at who actually signed the letter. With 2 exceptions, all the signatories are white. There are no Native Americans on there, no US Marshall Islanders, almost none of the Oppenheimer film cast and crew signed it. The last four signatures belong to the board of NTI. NTI was the brainchild of Fonda's ex, Ted Turner. NTI's CEO is, yes, Ernest Moniz, the former US Energy Secretary, who is at the forefront of promoting nuclear power to anyone and everyone who wants it. Turner is also a firm supporter of nuclear power. I know because I tried to challenge him on it once in person and was quickly deflected by a very large gentleman in possession of an impressive set of muscles. Moniz is one of the chief architects behind the pro-nuclear infiltration of the COP28 climate summit and its ridiculous "Let's triple global nuclear power capacity by 2050" proclamation. He will be in Brussels later this month, headlining the International Atomic Energy Agency's propaganda fest, billed as the first ever nuclear energy summit. So here we have a slightly star-studded, short-lived campaign to proclaim an end to one kind of nuke, while behind the scenes, the same organization is working hard to promote the other kind of nuke, thus ensuring that the door to nuclear weapons development stays firmly open. So sorry, no two thumbs up for this bit of Hollywood theater. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter of Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
On the website, we will have a link up to Linda's further comments on this issue, as well as a link to an article from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists entitled "Not Just Oppenheimer: How Other Scientists Tried to Change Nuclear Weapons Policy for the Better and How Some Succeeded." Over to Japan, where on Monday, March 11, marked 13 years since the devastating earthquake and tsunami struck the country's northeastern Tohoku region, resulting in the loss of over 22,000 lives and triggering the world's worst nuclear disaster at the Fukushima nuclear power station. The central government stopped hosting memorial services in Tokyo in 2022, but municipalities in the affected areas are now holding annual events on a smaller scale, where participants offer silent prayers to the disaster victims. In a statement, Greenpeace Japan extended heartfelt condolences to the victims and their families who are still suffering the aftermath of this devastating catastrophe. But their statement also focused on the January 1st 7.6 earthquake off the Noto Peninsula, where damage to transformer pipes at the Shika nuclear power plant nearby became inoperable, and two of the five external power lines ceased operation. The Shika reactors were in cold shutdown, so what could have been another Fukushima did not occur. As Greenpeace points out, despite discussions over evacuation plans in nuclear power plant areas over the past 13 years, it's evident that ensuring resident safety in the event of a nuclear accident coinciding with a major disaster is nearly impossible. In Ishikawa Prefecture, which is where the earthquake happened and the Shika reactors are located, the earthquake damaged more than 74,000 houses. Some roads were rendered impassable, hindering indoor and outdoor evacuations outlined in government guidelines for nuclear accidents. Despite steps that have been taken on nuclear power issues since the March 11, 2011 Fukushima disaster began, this unexpected setback underscores the persistent vulnerabilities of nuclear power. And at Futaba in Fukushima Prefecture, 13 years after the nuclear accident, a local post office has finally reopened, which the government is calling a symbolic step towards normalcy, as if the word normalcy will ever be applied to Fukushima again. The nuclear accident forced the evacuation of all 7,000 residents from the town. Currently, 102 people are living in Futaba, but notably, 60% of them are not originally from the town, and 85% of the town remains under evacuation orders. Yeah, normalcy. And the mega-budget Oscar-winning film Oppenheimer will finally be released in Japan on March 29. Kyoko Heia, president of the Japanese City's International Film Festival, said, "Is this really a movie that people in Hiroshima can bear to watch? It's very America-centric. And maybe it's time someone made a film about atomic bombs from the perspective of Japan or a Japanese person." Over to Ukraine, where safety at the Russian-held Zaporizhia nuclear power plant is worsening daily. This according to Ukraine's energy minister. German Galushenko. He said, the number of problems has only increased each day. Each day. The International Atomic Energy Agency's, IAEA's, 35-nation board of governors passed a resolution late last Thursday condemning Russia's occupation of Europe's biggest nuclear power plant and expressing grave concern at lack of staffing and maintenance 2 years after its capture. The facility has lost all external power 8 times in the last 18 months, forcing it to rely on diesel generators to cool the fuel in its reactors and avoid a potentially catastrophic meltdown. Before the war, there were around 1,500 staff at the plant. Now that number is around 4,500, while the number of staff present each day was only 2,000. The IAEA maintains a small presence at Zaporizhia. And in Canada, the nuclear industry wants that country to lift its ban on reprocessing plutonium despite proliferation risks. Reprocessing is any technology that extracts plutonium from used nuclear fuel and is the stuff out of which atomic bombs are made. There has been a ban against it in Canada for 45 years. Here's John LaForge, co-director of NukeWatch, with our monthly NukeWatch report, focusing on weapons, Europe, NATO, politics, and those who protest them.
Another peace activist from the United States has been sentenced to prison in Germany for daring to interfere with the threatened use of the U.S. nuclear weapons that are stationed there. Susan Crane of the Redwood City, California Catholic Worker has been ordered to serve 229 days after joining a string of nonviolent protests at Germany's Buchel Air Force Base, southeast of Cologne. Between 2017 and 2021, Susan joined 5 delegations of U.S. anti-nuclear activists to annual summer peace camps just outside the base, organized by NukeWatch and the local group Nonviolent Action to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. Crane participated in 6 nonviolent go-in actions, confronting the Air Force system on the base, which routinely trains to drop the U.S. H-bombs on targets in Russia. Most provocatively, this winter, in Operation Steadfast Defender, which was launched in the midst of NATO's war in Ukraine. As a result of misdemeanor convictions on charges of trespass and damage to the chain-link fence, Crane was ordered to pay penalties totaling 2,500 euros. Now, for refusing to admit guilt or pay fines, a mid-level court has ordered Crane to report on June 4 to Rohrbach, a 450-bed co-ed prison in southwest Germany. Crane's 7.5-month sentence could be the longest ever imposed in the 25-year-long series of rallies, protests, marches, peace camps, and civil resistance directed at the NATO nuclear weapons base. Crane is also the first U.S. woman to be ordered to a German prison in this decades-long effort. Crane said in her statement of March 6th, quote, "When we went on the base, we reminded the military that nuclear weapons are illegal and immoral. We asked them to resign their commissions, or, if so ordered, to refuse to load the nuclear weapons on their Tornado fighter jets and refuse to drop them anywhere." She continued, "I thought the German courts would listen to the reasons we went on the base and understand that our peaceful actions were justified acts of crime prevention, but international law was not respected." According to legal experts, the transfer of U.S. nuclear weapons from the United States to Germany, a non-nuclear weapon state, is prohibited by the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Articles 1 and 2 of the treaty explicitly forbid any transfer of nuclear weapons among parties to the treaty. In California, Crane has devoted her life to serving the poor and often homeless residents of Redwood City. In her statement, she said, quote, "I see people living in camps, living in cars, and I see working people who don't have enough income for basic needs like rent, food, or medical care. Then I think of the money wasted on war making by the U.S. and NATO nations, and that a mere 3% of the U.S. military budget alone could end starvation around the world. This wastefulness is a theft from the poor, a theft from all of us." Crane argued at trial that she was justified in attempting to interfere with the ongoing criminal conspiracy, the unlawful plan to wage wars of mass destruction, wars in violation of the Nuremberg Charter and Judgment, which, ironically, was imposed in Germany, even against German judges. Crane appealed the convictions all the way to Germany's highest court, which dismissed the appeal without comment, as it has in 19 similar protest cases. Then she appealed to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, France, just as five other resistors have, trying to raise high-level awareness and trying to prompt a judicial finding that condemns the menacing, perilous, and destabilizing near-Russia positioning of U.S. nukes. Last December, this European court rejected that appeal also, on a technicality, but without addressing the merits. Susan Crane says, "I don't want to give money to the court system, which I view as protecting nuclear weapons. I don't believe nonviolently resisting nuclear madness is wrong, and I don't need to apologize for it. Paying a fine would be like admitting some guilt, while refusing is a way of withdrawing my cooperation from the courts and from the judges who build a wall of silence and then hide behind it. They deny that threatening mass destruction is a criminal act, and they try to insulate themselves from their own complicity. I acted," she said, "to uphold this law, but they pretend that treaties don't apply in their courtrooms." End quote. Well, we wish Susan well in her return to prison. She's been to many in the United States, and hope her conscientious example is a bell ringer heard around the world. To write and support Susan, go to nukewatchinfo.org. This has been John LaForge for Nuclear Hot Seat.
We'll have this week's featured interview on nukes and money in just a moment. But first, I know that you care about getting honest nuclear news. And that's what we set out to provide here at Nuclear Hot Seat every week. Verifiable nuclear information that's been sourced, checked, and footnoted, plus interviews with people who are genuine experts on various aspects of the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you about people on the front lines of activism around the world, their triumphs, challenges, and how you can help. We get underneath the manicured exterior of mainstream media's nuclear stories to provide context and continuity, because we want you to understand what the issues are, what we are up against, and what any of us can do about it. But this show cannot survive without your support. So if you're grateful for the information you get from Nuclear Hot Seat, now is the time to help us out. We run on donations, and right now our expenses are far outstripping what we've been sent. So if you've ever thought that donating to Nuclear Hot Seat was a good idea, but you haven't done it yet, now is the exact right time to start. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible, and we make it easy for you to help. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. Or donate directly through Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small, no amount is too large, so don't wait. Be it a one-time donation or a recurring one every month, go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate now and help keep our nuclear news online. Whatever you can do to help, know that I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Want to know how to stop a nuke? Follow the money. And then take it away from the nuclear industry. Would you like to know how? Keep listening. We're talking with Mary Beth Gallagher, who is Director of Engagements for Domini Impact Investments, a mutual fund firm that's woman-led and, among other ethical choices, does not invest in any company that manufactures any part of nuclear weapons. I initially heard her speak last December at the United Nations Second Meeting of States Parties on the Treaty to Prohibit Nuclear Weapons. Listening to the quality and clarity of her information, and knowing that she works closely with the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, I knew that the listeners of Nuclear Hot Seat deserved to hear what she had to say. I spoke with Mary Beth Gallagher on January 26, 2024. Mary Beth Gallagher, it's great to have you here with us today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Hi, Libby. So nice to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start out with your background. First of all, how did you get to be a financial advisor?
My role is Director of Engagement at Domini Impact Investments, which is a mutual fund company investment firm. And I think my path to this role is like kind of even surprising to me. I studied environmental science and was a Peace Corps volunteer and really committed to doing climate change activism, and I'm a lawyer. I studied international human rights law and did a lot of advocacy work, really looking at the issues of our time around climate change and human rights, women's equality, and did advocacy work with like the United Nations, with human rights defenders, trying to change policies and practices. I'm really passionate a lot about a lot of these issues and kind of found my way into the financial community, first working with a community of faith-based investors, seeing that the role of finance of corporations in our society was really critical, and that investors have an opportunity to try to influence how companies operate, how responsible they are, how they treat their workers, and that working in the financial community was an opportunity to really think about what it means to support sustainable, healthy, resilient financial systems that don't leave people and the planet behind.
How long have you been with this financial institution doing this work?
Sure. So I joined Domini about 3 years ago in 2021. And prior to that, I was with a group called Investor Advocates for Social Justice for about 8 years. So in total, I've been in this field about 10 years.
What is the general stance within the financial community towards investing in nuclear weapons creating companies?
The general stance, I think, is probably pretty varied. I think there are some firms that don't think about the role of weapons, and others, like our firm, that really think about like how you align what you choose to invest in with what you care about.
Give us an example by letting us know what your company's, Domini's, stance is towards nuclear weapons.
Sure. So Domini is a women-led mutual fund company with a commitment to impact investing. We were founded about 30 years ago. And as we look at like our role in the financial system and what we invest in, we have a set of impact investment standards. So that guides how we evaluate what companies to invest in. And there are some sectors that we just automatically avoid, like fossil fuels, tobacco, immigrant detention centers, as well as nuclear weapons. So we have a screen against investing in nuclear weapons. We don't invest in any companies that manufacture them. We don't invest in companies that produce nuclear power. And then we also look at different institutions that may have connections to the nuclear weapons issue, like universities or also governments that have large nuclear arsenals.
In the general financial community, have there been any changes in their stance towards nuclear weapons creating companies in recent years?
I think since the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons entered into force in 2021, you have seen more investment institutions looking at screens and prohibitions against nuclear weapons. There's a really useful resource that's been developed by PACS called Don't Bank on the Bomb. And their recent report from 2023 showed that the number of investors that are ex either have a screen completely excluding nuclear weapons, like Domini does, or the firms that are looking closely at it and selectively excluding nuclear companies has increased over time. So I think that number is around 110 investment firms that are completely excluding investments in nuclear weapons or reducing that exposure. And I think that's grown progressively over time as that report has been done, periodically looking at those firms that have a public position. And you're seeing more investors, I think, look at this because of the role of the treaty. And because that brings in potential enabling actors in production of nuclear weapons, which may touch on financial institutions.
How do you identify the companies that are invested in nuclear weapons that you choose to avoid?
We have a team of research analysts at our firm that look closely at every company that we are deciding whether or not we can invest in, and they do research to look at what a company's core business model is. So they'll look at their financial documents, they'll look at the company's sustainability reports, and they really dig into how does this company generate revenue? What's their business model? And we have certain thresholds. So if a company generates a certain amount of their business from nuclear weapons, they would be automatically excluded. So more than 10% of their annual revenue from nuclear weapons would be excluded. If it's between like a 5 and a 10% amount of their revenue is from that, we would generally exclude it, probably more likely. And then less than 5% of their revenue from nuclear weapons production, we would look at it case by case, but really looking kind of with a negative bias towards investing in that. We look at different factors, like, are they a market leader? Is this their long-term business strategy? Is their messaging really closely tied with the nuclear weapons production? Or are they demonstrating, this is for those companies that aren't significant producers, are they showing that they're moving away from this business? But generally, we have these thresholds where we look at how much of a company's business activity comes from producing nuclear weapons and dig into what their revenue is from. We might look at those lists of government contractors or resources that groups put together to just get a full spectrum of what those companies are. And like ICANN and PACS have also done reporting that's really helpful on those nuclear producing companies. So you can see those names. But my colleagues who are research analysts are really trying to dig in to make sure we have accurate information. And that's one thing that we look at in the investment community is good disclosure. So companies are disclosing their links to nuclear weapons, and that helps more of us to make decisions based on like what is the company's actual business activity and do we want to invest in them?
Many of these companies, I would say the majority of them, are enormous and are known to be very profitable in the business sector. Certainly, they get the majority of the money that's coming dealing with nuclear in order to support the government's stated aims about that. Is there any sense of ridicule or put down or snubbing that comes from those financial institutions that still invest in nuclear, that look at what you're doing, what your company is doing, and think, you know, they're really missing a bet here. They're really stupid. Why are they doing this?
Maybe, but I think for our firm, we really stand on our values and our impact investment standards. So we know that investors who choose to invest with a firm like Domini or those others who are highlighted in the PACS reporting are choosing their investments because they want to invest with a firm that is aligned with their values, that's investing in the kind of world we want to see. So we have done modeling and research over time to look at financial performance and the impact of our screens and standards on financial performance, and that modeling is favorable over time. That's not my area of expertise, so I would leave that to others within the firm to speak to, but we believe strongly that companies that produce things that people need, that are safe, that are accessible, that are fair, are companies that will do well in the long term, and that for investors, you don't need to have those companies in your portfolio to get the kind of returns and have that long-term financial stability that you're really looking for when you make an investment. So I think it's a bit of a false choice to say you're missing out if you exclude these companies, because we actually feel like instead we're able to put money towards things like the renewable energy transition or companies that are making medicines that are accessible and affordable and fair. So thinking about what you want to put your money into in lieu of weapons is part of our approach as well.
I initially became aware of you when I heard you speak at the United Nations last November for the second meeting of states parties on the treaty to prohibit nuclear weapons. You were on a panel that was put together by ICANN, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons. What has been your or your company's connection with ICANN, and is there any kind of ongoing relationship?
Yeah, we really are grateful for the work and leadership of ICANN to raise visibility, to provide opportunities for collaboration and education. Right alongside the meeting of the states parties in November, we co-hosted an event with ICANN really geared toward the financial community and those of us who are looking at this issue as it intersects with the economy. So we had several colleagues from investment firms, research providers, experts who are able to speak to the issue. And part of that was to signal that the financial community is part of this conversation and recognizes it has a role. This wasn't the first event that we co-hosted with ICANN. We did that several years ago as well, because we recognize there's really a close alignment in values there between the work that they're advancing and the approach that we have as an investment firm. At the meeting of the States parties, we had that side event that you referenced, which was really an opportunity for us to signal the support of the financial community. And in terms of the outcomes of that meeting, it seems like identifying stakeholders that could be relevant partners presents an opening and an opportunity for the financial community to really step into this work, to signal our support and really build that norm against investment in nuclear weapons.
Is there any kind of an organization or a group that meets representing the various financial institutions that are ethical and looking for more peaceful ways to invest their money? Do you get together to support each other?
Yeah, there's, I think, a really beautiful amount of collaboration among the impact investment, responsible investment community. It doesn't necessarily happen around the issue of nuclear weapons per se, but there are spaces where we do collaboration around issues like biodiversity, like climate change and worker rights, networks like the PRI, Principles for Responsible Investing, or the Interfaith Center on Corporate Responsibility, ICCR, where we can gather and share ideas and look for opportunities where we can collaborate. There has been some really good organizing by the firm Etika Seeger alongside ICANN to put together an investor statement that was supported by over 100 investors and was delivered at the meeting of the States parties that has really clear expectations from the financial community. So we find different ways to where there's common cause to come together and signal that we care about these issues. We look for opportunities to amplify the message, educate each other, learn about the issues. And I think that increasing awareness among the investor community that was reflected in the Don't Bank the Bomb report shows that more and more investors are looking at this issue and trying to figure out, like, what data do you use? How do you figure this out? What kind of company research are you looking at? Are there places we can go to find the companies that we should avoid? So as those resources are developed, more and more investors can apply their position and their stance against nuclear weapons investing.
How do you bring this opportunity, this stance of the company, to the awareness of investors who perhaps are looking around but haven't yet gotten in contact with you?
When we're looking to raise visibility among like other institutional investors or investment firms, things like that statement I referenced are an opportunity to think about others who share this issue, this interest, and who want to invest aligned with their values. So there are some collaborations that are taking place. A group in Europe called Shareholders for Change, for example, has mobilized investors around this. By hosting that event together with ICANN, Domini was also putting our name out there as a firm that's interested in building collaborations and sharing education and resources and creating a conversation around avoiding nuclear weapons investing. And then for the individual person, like a saver, a pensioner, someone who has a 401k or an IRA that wants to think about how they could better align their investments, there are tools and platforms that are resources, like As You Sow, for example, is a group that has different kinds of screens so you can see what are fossil-free investment firms, firms that look against weapons. So an individual investor can find other firms like Domini, or again, the PAX report shows that list of 110 firms that have already made this commitment. So I think for the individual who's looking to invest in a way that's aligned with their values, it starts with asking questions about, like, does your firm look at nuclear weapons? Are you investing in any of those companies that make them? If you are investing in those companies, how are you using your voice to try to influence them and change their behavior, or looking to exit from them, recognizing that changing their behavior might be a long haul?
How much money does an individual have to have an influence on this process?
I mean, I think every dollar invested in the market has an impact. So we really think about putting your money into what you believe the world should stand for and what it should look like. So I would say anyone who has the opportunity to invest should be looking at where they're investing and how they're investing. To open a mutual fund with a firm that has like an impact investment approach. You don't need more than a few thousand dollars, but you can also think about where you're banking. There are banks that are also investing in or financing nuclear weapons. So if even your checking or savings account could be tied to nuclear weapons companies. So I think from an influence standpoint, we really all need to be together and aligned in this. And part of that is creating a norm and a signal. Are we going to get these companies to change their practices overnight by choosing not to invest in them? I'm not sure that's the point of our decisions. Our decisions are to say, I don't want my money going towards this end. And also, there's a norm building around investment firms that are making a similar decision. And eventually that will have repercussions on the company's financial performance or ability to raise capital in the long term. But it's really also part of a movement of standing in solidarity, being public about our position, and thinking about what we'll choose to invest in.
Don't Bank on the Bomb has a superb program that includes ways that people who have extremely modest amounts of money, we're not even talking thousands here, but anyone who has an account can contact their local bank and raise this issue. Not that their amount of money is going to change the stance of the company, but by raising the issue of where are you invested? Are you invested in nuclear weapons creating companies? They will not necessarily have that answer. So what happens is that the question gets raised within the company. So it's not a matter of how much money you have, but whether you have a connection to any kind of a financial institution at all, or a pension or a 401k, anything that will allow you to bring up this subject and have a definite impact.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the work I do, so my role is director of engagement. My work is about asking questions of companies. And I think it all really starts with raising the visibility of an issue. So in my work as director of engagement, I meet with companies that our firm is invested in. And I try to understand how they're managing, whether it's climate change or workers' right to form a union or address topics like racial justice and diversity on the board. It starts with that question and inquiry, and then brings other people to the table, and the company then has to answer those questions and direct their attention to it. And I think it helps to shape the conversation that investors care about, not just how profitable you are in this quarter, but what kind of company you are, what you're creating, how you treat communities that live adjacent to a factory, or the workers who are producing your products, or the farm workers who are growing the food that you sell in your supermarket. Really, a company's whole business has these impacts. And we know that by asking questions, we start to shape conversations and signal what matters. And then companies have to look for that information, provide that information to their investors, and then investors are able to incorporate that into their decisions about whether to invest in a company. And so, to reinforce your point, for anyone who has a relationship with a credit card company, a bank, a mutual fund, their IRA that they're offered through their company, it's really important to ask about how that aligns with your values, whether it's about nuclear weapons or nuclear weapons testing or nuclear power. Like, all of these questions are important to inquire about.
This, of course, is all of great interest and importance to Nuclear Hot Seat listeners. But I'm wondering, how has the rest of the media responded to your message? Because I do not recall seeing this in mainstream media. What kind of coverage have you gotten, and how positive or opposed to you has it been?
Well, the broader field that we're part of looks at environmental social governance investing, or ESG investing. And I think there's increasing awareness of that type of investing, where you're looking at environmental impacts and social impacts. When it comes specifically to the issue of nuclear weapons, I think we're pleased to see one of the main financial press outlets pick up coverage of the event we co-hosted with ICANN around the meeting of the states' parties. And part of their message was similar to what you've asked earlier about the growing interest and awareness of this issue. So I would say, overall, looking at the influence that firms like ours can have on companies, is periodically a subject of interest. I wouldn't say that attention is as much as we would need to start to influence companies, but topics like climate change, I think, are really high on people's agenda. And there are a lot of intersections between the impacts of nuclear weapons or the environmental health impacts that are connected to issues that people care about. And part of our work is to build those connections. Nuclear weapons seem like something so abstract and unlikely and kind of disconnected from the day-to-day. And so for investors like Domini that look at issues with kind of a systemic lens, we see this as related to topics we care about, like biodiversity and environmental health and climate change. And that some of the work that ICANN has done has really helped to draw those linkages and help people understand how important this issue is. I don't have more commentary around the mainstream media coverage generally because our work is not always in the press. So I can't say it's more or less than other things.
What further involvement do you and Domini foresee in your work with ICANN or Don't Bank on the Bomb?
Yeah, I think there is a need to continue to build a relationship with ICANN and think about explicitly what the role of the financial sector is related to the treaty. Are there responsibilities for investors and companies that are triggered by the treaty that we need to be aware of? And then for us to think about how to deepen or strengthen or ensure that our standards are kind of like always in the right spot, that there aren't emerging issues that we should be looking at, ICANN can be a source resource for that. And I think as more investors are interested in exploring their connection to nuclear weapons, we can be like a bridge or entry point for them to connect with groups like ICANN. So as the member states continue to meet about the treaty, I think we'll look to see what the role of the financial community should be and can be. We can support an enabling policy environment where we can advocate for countries to adopt the treaty maybe, or as a US investor, for example, we don't invest in US treasuries because of the stance of the United States government and the large nuclear weapons arsenal. Advocacy towards the US government around the treaty may not be that easy or successful, but I think we can take other stances where we're looking at the role of governments and the role of investors in supporting that.
So as an individual with admittedly extremely modest means, if I or someone like me was to get involved with making certain that whatever money I have does go towards ethical investing, how would I get started? What would you suggest?
Thinking about the issues that matter to you would be the first step. So what are you looking for when you're choosing an ethical investment? There are firms like ours that have a broad set of impact investment standards where we're looking at topics like ecological sustainability, so climate change, environmental health, and universal human dignity, so like justice and fairness and human rights. And we're applying that set of standards across all of our investments. For an investor that's looking for a firm that like takes that approach, it starts with understanding how do they choose what to invest in and what to avoid. So I think it starts with research, with thinking about what matters to you. If you invest with a financial advisor or through another platform, you can probably find information about those kind of expectations. There are groups, we're part of this organization called USCIF, the Sustainable Investment Forum, and they have a resource about firms that have commitments to sustainable investing. And there are resources available for the everyday investor. I think it starts with that value setting, like what do you care about? And then trying to find a firm that aligns with that set of values.
And in terms of returns, how are such things measured and how does ethical investing shape up in terms of return on investment?
I would direct you to our website where you can find more information about our performance, because that is something where we disclose all of that in our fund fact sheets and our quarterly reporting. And an investor can really dig in and see how our performance aligns with what their needs are. I think there's strong conviction in our founders and our firm's leadership that companies that are well managed, that are responsible, that have good governance, that treat their stakeholders well, will perform well in the long term. And in terms of evaluating performance, because that's not necessarily my role, I don't feel well equipped to speak to that, but I think it's important to dig into that and make sure that the stance of the firm and the performance you're getting meet your needs.
In winding up, Is there anything else you'd like to say that we haven't covered yet?
I wanted to speak a little bit about our position with our bond fund and investing in sovereigns. So we have a unique stance related to investing in US treasuries, which is that we avoid US treasuries because of the large budget of the US government to invest in the nuclear weapons arsenal. And so instead of that, we invest in affordable housing or healthcare systems or things that are more public goods and creating access to basic goods and services. I mentioned that just to say that across the spectrum of investments, really there are different places where our commitment to avoid investing in nuclear weapons shows up. And one of those is with our stance against investing in US treasuries.
And what's the minimum amount of money that an individual investor would have to be able to call up Dominion and say, look, let's talk about investing?
So if an individual investor wanted to invest with Domini, they would first start at our website. And the minimum amount to open an investment fund is about $1,500 to $2,500, depending on the type of fund you're looking to open. And through our website, you can find all of that information.
What would an investor looking for information do? Where would they go and what would they have to type in and what would they get as a result? Give us one example.
Yeah, so one resource that's really helpful is the As You Sow Weapons Free Fund website. On that website, you can type into the screen the name of any mutual fund, so like our firm or another firm that you're looking to invest in. It gives you a grade actually on, it says military weapons grade, and it ranks those firms on like A through F, I guess. And it lists specifically what stock holdings that firm may be invested in that are military contractors that produce nuclear weapons or that are manufacturers of controversial weapons. So that screen really helps to do a lot of the research for you on investment firms and what is within the funds. Because like a firm like Domini, we're a mutual fund company, we invest in hundreds of companies, and that's all public on our website. You could see it in our quarterly disclosures. That's not necessarily that easy to go through if you're an individual investor that's looking to see, like, they say they don't invest in nuclear. Is it true? A resource like this Weapons Free Fund website helps to do some of that work for you and looks through the portfolio of the different funds and gives them that evaluation and then names specifically the companies within the portfolio that are triggered by that screen around nuclear weapons, controversial weapons, or contractors. Some of these tools that are out there really help do the work for an individual investor that wants to make sure, whether it's fossil-free funds or weapon-free or immigrant detention centers, there are resources that will help an investor to align with their values when they're making that decision. Etica SGR has worked with a group called Shareholders for Change, and they organized an investor statement that they delivered at the second meeting of the state's parties. And that was signed by 111 institutional investors with over $1 trillion invested, that encourages countries to sign the treaty, urges state parties to require state-owned enterprises to align with the TPNW, extend the treaty obligations to non-state actors, and also outlines a commitment for the investors that signed that statement not to finance or invest in companies involved in nuclear weapons production. So that was a real advocacy opportunity for the investment community to speak directly at the second meeting of the state's parties. And the firm Etica SGR delivered that investor statement there.
We will, of course, link to that URL on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode. Mary Beth Gallagher, you have again proven to be a source of a wealth of information. I was extremely impressed by the session that I attended at the United Nations, and I'm delighted that I was able to finally secure you for an interview. So thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you, Libby, so much for having me. It was really a pleasure to speak with you today.
That was Mary Beth Gallagher, who is Director of Engagements for Domini Impact Investments, a New York-based mutual fund firm that is woman-led and, as policy, does not and has never invested in nukes. The links Mary Beth mentioned during our interview will be posted on the website nuclearhotseat.com under this episode number 664.
Activist, shout out.
And further congratulations to the founders of Just Moms STL, Dawn Chapman and Karen Nickel. They've been in D.C. recently lobbying for the passage of RECA, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, and working closely with Senator Josh Hawley. In respect of their work, Hawley invited them to attend last Thursday's State of the Union address, an honor these women have earned and so deeply deserve for their work on the cleanup of legacy Manhattan Project radioactive waste from their neighborhood. Congratulations to them both. And calling all students enrolled in school anywhere in the United States. Are you a poet? You want to give it a shot? Hanford Challenge is running the Hot Poetry Contest for poems written about students on the topic of nuclear weapons waste. Submissions are due by March 31st, 2024, and cash prizes will be provided for at least one and up to five winners. The winners will be announced as of April, and we will have links up to the submission form and other resources on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 664. And a heads up that next week's Nuclear Hot Seat is going to be a full-length special on my recent trip to the opening of the North American tour of the International Uranium Film Festival. I was in Window Rock, Navajo Nation, for 2 days of not only films, but the people who came whose lives have been so deeply entwined with and damaged by their exposure to uranium, uranium mines, uranium mining, and the Church Rock uranium tailings spill accident. That will be next week's Nuclear Hot Seat number 664, posting on March 19, 2024. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, March 12, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it so easy. Go to the website, nuclearhotseat.com. The yellow box pops up right away, and if you fill in your first name and an email address, you will get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered directly to you every week as soon as it posts. You can also subscribe on any of your favorite podcast channels. But if you do it through the website, you're on my database, and Google pays attention to that and moves us up in the rankings. Whichever, sign up to make certain that you do not miss a single episode of Nuclear Hot Seat, because there's always more when it comes to nuclear. And speaking of that more, you can help me find out what it is. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help and appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024. Libby Halevi and Hardestry Communications. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, the website, and the names of anyone whose comments you use, including me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that as Gandhi said, the future depends on what you do today. There you go. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the Nuclear Hot Seat.
Nuclear Hot Seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear Hot Seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear Hot Seat. It's da bomb.